So this article was written in 1985 by Ted Irving in the section called Tectonics, and the title is Whence British Columbia? The paleomagnetic measurement of very large displacements among continents in the mid-1950s was followed by a decade of skepticism until evidence from the oceans made the case for global mobility unassailable. Similarly, measurements in the early 1950s of very large displacements in deformed belts within the confines of a modern continent met a large measure of disbelief. The orthodox view was that mountain belts were formed more or less where they are now. Recently, geologically young displacements have been found further and further eastward in the Cordillera, especially in the Canadian sector, as if the assemblaged patchwork of blocks had moved northwards as a whole mini-continent during the Laramide Orogeny when the Rockies were formed. And that's between 80 and 50 million years ago. In scene 5, you will hear me talk about, it's just as a brief mention about the Iapetus Ocean opening up. So I didn't speak about Rodinia, since I am talking about the Lonioki, which wasn't the plan before, because if you notice right from scene 1, no, scene 2, when we go to Swayze, 1965, and we listen to the chief healer and Professor Bohm talking about the Surunyoki and the Ilonyoki and how the Surunyoki floods, but the Ilonyoki's flooding was prehistoric because it stopped flooding, it's now running dry. So I think I want to kind of connect this prehistoric flooding, not the Great Ice Age floods for sure, hopefully not. This is a fun project, like I mentioned before, it's actually just a fictional project now.
Welcome to Sartastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. This podcast is dedicated to Fraser Mendonca, who left Denver and Leti in September 2023 before their October road trip to Northern BC and the Yukon.
Scene 5, January 1976, Yukon Highway 6, Canole Road, somewhere between Quiet Lake and Finlayson Lake.
Aranya, how did you know that we would come here after listening to the Chief Healer's message in Swayze? And what are you doing with the Yukon Tanana terrain map? I thought I hinted at the geology of the Peace River embayment during our last conversation, didn't I?
Yes, you did, Professor Scamander. And I started reading about the Peace River Arch as soon as we got back to Fraysden, so I could answer my question about the Ilonyoki and its flooding. I kind of knew that we would be going back to 1976 because Professor Bohm had figured out a clue during one of those 1976 dialogues with the Chief Healer. And I've kind of heard those so many times, so I think I had figured the clue. So I was clear on the year, and that's why I said 1976, but I had no clue about the location. From our last conversation, I learned that I was quite close to Mount Schaefer in Old Crow. So here's my guess. I think that the flooding of the Ilonyoki is considered as a good event because it was enfolding the map of the Deathly Hallows.
Not bad at all, Aranya. I see how you made the Yukon connection there, which is correct, by the way. But I am still curious. How did you narrow down to this location near Canole Road? Also, what led you to the Yukon in the first place? Because I think your primary study sites, weren't they in the glacially induced fault zones of Sodankyla and Kittila? You were supposed to be in Lapland, weren't you? We had not revealed anything to you. And like you said, I was deflecting for the most part and trying to keep you away from Old Crow. So just curious, what inspired this redirection?
You were keeping me away from the Yukon, but Professor Long was leading me straight to it. I don't know if I mentioned to you, but we had a field trip in Newfoundland. This was on magical water plants and fossilized marine animals. I think this was around the Avalon Peninsula. No, I think it was the Buran Peninsula. Yes, it was the Buran Peninsula first, and then we moved to the Avalon Peninsula. It was actually a herbology field trip, but then I was more interested in fossilized marine animals. So I asked Professor Longbottom if he had any specific notes on, or if you could point me to something on fossilized marine animals, since it was kind of a herbology trip on water plants and I wasn't so interested in magical water plants at the time. So he gave me Professor Long's notes. And when I came across those notes, he had mentioned brachiopods and trilobites. And then he also had this, long letter on the closing of the Iapetus Ocean and some correspondence with Ted Irving. All of that seemed odd to me because Professor Long was not associated with the paleo world at all. Or at least that's the impression I had during my research on thestrals and their paleo habitat, because I had no evidence of his interest at the time. But I don't know, how did Professor Longbottom find those notes and what inspired him to share those notes with me in the first place? It was actually Ted Irving's papers that helped me redirect my research toward Western Canada. In one of his papers, there was a reference to upper Paleozoic fauna in the Western Cordillera. And in that paper, there was a plate tectonic model that hints at northward translation of the Western Cordillera with respect to cratonic North America. And that completely piqued my interest because the paleo habitat markers that I had found seemed quite anomalous around the Quiet Lake batholith. And so I dug some more and I read through a lot, I think at least 22 papers on PaleoMag. And in one of those, I came across Professor Johnston's Big Flush claim. And this Big Flush claim was about a massive northward translation of the Carmacks group and its paleolocation connection to the Yellowstone hotspot. This paper saved me a ton of time because at the time I was traveling aimlessly around the Idaho-Montana-Wyoming boundaries trying to settle this Quiet Lake anomaly that I had found in the Yukon. That was how this whole thing got started for me, and I was heading in that direction actually to set up another study site around the Quiet Lake batholith, but my colleague found another strong anomaly along the Porcupine River near Rampart House, and that's how we ended up setting our study site near Bluefish River instead of Quiet Lake. If we had not spoken about Mount Schaefer, I would not have been able to make the connection. It was only after our last conversation where this whole Quiet Lake anomaly started to unfold for me. And that's when I revisited Professor Johnston's papers and some more PaleoMag papers, and then reassessed my question about the Ilon-Yokey flooding. All these threads seemed to connect at the Yukon-Tanana terrain. That's my best guess for why we are here, and that's why I have this Yukon-Tanana terrain map. That's just me guessing the location. I know we should be in 1976, but I don't know if we should be at this location. Are we at the correct location in the dead of winter, Professor Scamander? Quiet Lake and Finlayson Lake map areas are of particular interest because they straddle Tintina Trench and lie close to the northwestern extremity of the Ominaka crystalline belt, where it merges with the Yukon crystalline terrain. Fieldwork in the 1975 field season continued. Stratigraphic and structural studies of the northern extremity of the Ominaka crystalline belt begun in 1973. Templeman Cluett completed regional mapping of Quiet Lake map area and part of Finlayson Lake map area, and this report is a summary of the main findings of that work. Reed completed fieldwork in a study of Lower Cambrian strata near Ketsa River, which will form the basis of a master's thesis at the University of Calgary. Principal findings of this work were published earlier by Templeman Cluett et al. In 1975. Reed also began a detailed study of the Silurian and Devonian platform-like succession off the Pelly Mountains, and a summary of that work is contained herein. Gordy studied the structural style south of the Tintina Trench in Finlayson Lake map area, and this will form the basis for his doctoral dissertation at Queen's University. Two contrasting sequences of stratified rocks are exposed in the Pelly Mountains. On the northeast, near the Tintina Trench, a succession of shale, sandstone, and carbonate rocks was deposited during shallow marine conditions near the margin of the stable continental platform. This myogeoclinal succession ranges in age from late Proterozoic to Triassic. On the southwest, a late Paleozoic metamorphosed eogeoclinal assemblage, which includes argillaceous chert, siliceous tuff basalt, and serpentinite occur. The eogeoclinal assemblage lies in an alloctonous sheet above the autochthonous myogeoclinal succession. The autochthonous succession is imbricated by large northeast-directed thrust faults, and the alloctonous assemblage is broken by steep faults. All the rocks were arched over two large northwest-trending anticlines, which were the locus of relatively long-lived heat flow, accompanied by intrusion of elongate mid-Cretaceous granitic batholiths. Transcurrent movement along the Tintina Fault occurred shortly after the intrusive event. All right, so this is stratigraphic and structural studies in the Pelly Mountains, Yukon Territory. And this is a 1976 report. Late Precambrian and Lower Precambrian stratigraphy near Ketzer River. Green argillite with interbedded siltstone and quartzite forms the base of the hill. Brown limey argillite and argillaceous limestone, that's over there, with archaeocyted reefs, and they comprise the lowest fossiliferous beds, and is capped by a medium-bedded limestone, that's the first line, found extensively in the Lower Cambrian, both in the Pelly Mountains and in other parts of the Omineka crystalline belt. That is interesting. So you have late Precambrian, and they say that the eogeoclinal succession, which lies in the alloctonous sheet, moves above the myogeoclinal succession. That's how the layering is. 1 minute. So Proterozoic, most likely, we'll have to see the dates there, Neo-Proterozoic, and also Lower Cambrian. Then you move to the mid-Paleozoic, that is the Ordovician, Silurian, and Devonian. So the first figure is a schematic diagram of facies relations in myogeoclinal strata of the Pelly Mountains. And that shows the alloctonous eogeoclinal assemblage on top. We're looking at northeast and southwest. Okay. So at the bottom layer is an orange weathering limestone, followed by green argillite, followed by sandstone and siltstone, followed again by green argillite, another layer, and then you have brown limey argillite above that. Then we're coming to medium-bedded grey limestone. Okay, I see that line there. Then you have orange weathering calcareous phyllite. Then that's followed up, piled up. There's another layer of cake above that called black graptolithic slate. And then above that is brown platy dolomitic siltstone. Wow, that's a multi-layered cake. Then there's a light grey thick-bedded dolomite shallow marine. Okay, that's the shallow marine deposit. Just above it on the right side. But the left side has a flow of the dark grey silty argillite with lenses of dark grey limestone. That's on the left. That's on the towards the southwest. But on the northeast side, there's another layer, which is the brown silty dolomite intertidal to supratidal. Next, we have black siliceous slate and orange weathering chert. And then above that is acid submarine tuff. And then I think the final layer is medium grey silty limestone. That's an 80 kilometer stretch from the southwest to the northeast. So we have a multi-layered cake. Then the second figure says that it's brown limey argillite and argillaceous limestone. Let's look at that. Brown limey argillite right above the green argillite. Yes, okay, that's the next level. So green argillite, level one, interbedded with sandstone and siltstone, level two. Level three is again green argillite. They form one layer, the base of the hill, and then that's piled up with level, the next level, which is level four, which is brown limey argillite, followed by level five, medium bedded grey limestone. So in between the two, you have archaeocyted reef area, just some reef area coming up, which I think shows up in the diagram, because yeah, there is something here, some disturbance, so that could be the reef area. When you look at the hill near the Ketzer River, it peaks at one. They are found extensively in the Lower Cambrian, both in the Pelly Mountains and in other parts of the Omineka crystalline belt. The next figure, figure 3, says an angular unconformity between Silurian brown, thin-bedded dolomitic siltstone with lenses of intermediate tuff and lower and middle Devonian light grey thick-bedded dolomite in west central Finlayson Lake map area. Ordovician black slate with tuff lenses underlie the siltstone conformably. Wait, let's go to figure one again. Yeah, they're brown platy dolomitic siltstone. So this is the Finlayson area. Moving on, figure 4 says bird's eye structure in dolomitized mudstone, middle Devonian, near Porcupine Creek. Yes, Porcupine Creek is where we were standing, indicating a supratidal environment of deposition. That's exactly where we were in the story. Supratidal environment of deposition. And then figure 5 says oncolites in dolomitic siltstone, middle Devonian, indicating intertidal environment of deposition. That's the same one then for figure 4 and 5. Brown silty dolomite intertidal to supratidal. That's the layer that it's referring to, figures 4 and 5. Where does this layer fit in? It's coming above the light gray thick bedded dolomite, shallow marine. And then is there another figure 6? Yep. Brown bioturbated argillaceous siltstone found in the starved shallow marine sequence beneath Triassic beds in the Pelly Mountains. Okay, so that's figure 6. Then you come to figure 7, grey thin-bedded silty and sandy limestone with abundant fossil fragments and rounded limestone clasts deposited under shallow marine conditions with relatively high energy in the Triassic. These are the youngest rocks of the Myogeoclinal sequence in the Pelly Mountains. And then figure 8, a single limestone unit lower Cambrian about 150 meter thick. It's repeated at least 10 times by northeast dipping, northeast directed thrust faults, northwest of Big Salmon Lake. Only a few of these repetitions are seen in this view, in which the imbricate sheets are numbered arbitrarily. Then you have figure 9. It says thick bedded, competent middle Devonian dolomite lies in the core of the syncline on Cambro or Division calcareous phyllite with tough lenses. The incompetent phyllite is deformed internally by small-scale transposition of bedding, but the dolomite is broken only by large faults and lacks internal small-scale deformational structures. A surface of detachment separates the two sequences. The dolomite in the core of the syncline lies in four discrete fault-bounded slabs. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yes, there are four fault-bounded slabs. The Cambro Ordovician phyllite is separated from the underlying Mississippian black slate. 1 minute. The phyllite is separated from the underlying Mississippian black slate, which is missed by the Porcupine thrust. So the Porcupine thrust is the line that separates that. It's a large synclinally folded northeast-directed thrust fault. So you have three layers here. You have the middle Devonian dolomite. It's got its own fault separations, so there are four chunks that come up. Then you have the Cambro Ordovician phyllite, a calcareous phyllite with tough lenses. That's four. So they are separated by the detachment. And then finally, you have the Porcupine thrust running through, separating the Cambro Ordovician phyllite from the Mississippian black slate. Now let's go back to figure 9. Let's go back to figure 1. I think I saw all those there. They didn't mention that as a Mississippian black slate. So there is a black slate right here, separated by the Porcupine thrust. Right above should be the thick-bedded dolomite. Right above should be the thick-bedded dolomite, yeah. Okay, that's there. One. Okay, so that's figure 9. And mapped it up to the first figure. Let's go to figure 10. Transposed bedding in dark gray, thin laminated calcareous phyllite, Cambro Ordovician. Crystallization of mica along the crenulation cleavage is seen locally. This style of deformation is characteristic of Cambro Ordovician rocks in much of the Ominica crystalline belt. All right, this I get. Then we come to figure 11. Serpentinized peridotite forms the resistant outcrop on the top of the Dunite Mountain and lies as a flat sheet on the Myogeoclinal sequence. The peridotite mass is interpreted as a loch thinness here, and its lower contact is thought to be a regional thrust fault, modified in many places by folding, faulting, an intrusion. It shows a delineation between autochthon and allochthon. On the allochthonous side, you have serpentinized peridotite right on top, and then serpentinite right below it. Then you have the line of control, the delineation between the two. Then we moved into the autochthonous succession. And there you start with the black slate with lenses of ortho, quartzite and dolomite. And on the southwest side, you have limestone. And then you move up to the first, you have late Proterozoic mica schist with limestone lenses. Those are limestone lenses over Proterozoic. So you've gone to Precambrian, right? Yeah, Precambrian. Above that is on the southwest side, limestone. On the northeast side, you would see black slate with dolomite. Then you move to the allochthonous, which kind of came up there. And that's serpentinite and serpentinized peridotite right on top. Oh, this is starting to make sense. Next, we have a nice map on figure 12, a sketch map of the distribution of eogeoclinal and myogeoclinal strata in the northern Omineka crystalline belt. Mesozoic intrusions are omitted. In the Pelly Mountains, the eogeoclinal strata are thrust over the myogeoclinal sequences. They are thrust over the myogeoclinal sequences, and a similar relationship modified in many places by younger phenomena is postulated on trend. The allochthonous eogeoclinal rocks are offset by mid-Cretaceous movement of the Tintina Fault. Are we talking about Baja BC? At a distance of about 450 kilometers. Rocks in the Yukon crystalline terrain are the continuation of those in the allochthonous part of the Omineka crystalline belt. Now, when you look at the map, rocks in the Yukon are a continuation of the allochthonous part of the Omineka. Okay, so that's the Omineka, the OBC, Omineka OCB, crystalline belt, right? OCB. Allochthonous margin is defined by Mesozoic intrusion. Let's go back to our map. We finished all of this. Now we are coming into the Triassic. So you see the Gulf of Alaska. Let's go from west to east. You see the Gulf of Alaska and you have the insular belt, right? There's also the separation of the Yukon and BC. Mesozoic, volcanic rocks and successor sediments. All right. Late Paleozoic, mainly eogeoclinal assemblage, upper green schist facies and lower grades. And then you have Proterozoic and Paleozoic. Autochthonous myogeoclinal assemblage. 1 minute. From late Proterozoic to Triassic is the story. And the area from the late Proterozoic to middle Paleozoic, you are talking about, I think Devonian is where it stops. They do talk about Ordovician, Silurian and Devonian together. So I think they stop there. And then you have the late Paleozoic eogeoclinal assemblage. So let's look at the map. Tintina Fault on the right. Imagine where Dawson is. On the right is the Selwyn Fault Belt. You see the offset of 450 kilometers that they talk about. There's an offset of 450 kilometers, right? They say the allochthonous eogeoclinal rocks are offset by mid-Cretaceous movement. That could very well be the Baja BC time. Aren't we in the same when we talk about the mid-Cretaceous? So there is a 450 kilometer offset. Anvil, Campbell, Allochthon. Still in the fault zone. We now move to the west of the Tintina fault zone. You see the Yukon crystalline terrain, Allochthon. Rocks in the Yukon crystalline terrain are the continuation of those in the allochthonous part of the Omineka crystalline belt. Shows Fairbanks is also part of the same. And then you see the Denali fault, the Denali Shakwak fault, the Coast Plutonic complex. We're coming down to, now we're coming down from the crystalline terrain to Carmax, which starts to show volcanic rocks and successor sediments. And the Teslin fault is there. So now we are in the intermontane belt with the White Horse Trough. There is the Big Salmon Lake. We are in the Atlin terrain belt, which is again, now wait, the Carmax was in Mesozoic. Volcanic rocks and successor sediments makes sense because we are talking about the Upper Cretaceous changes and the Carmax group has links with the Baja BC story. So then that area, the West White Horse Trough, Teslin Fault. Now, when you move away from White Horse down south towards after the border, no, actually not, just slightly before. So you're talking about Teslin as well. We move back to late Paleozoic, the Atlin terrain. Still part of the intermontane belt, but the Atlin terrain. It's interesting that the intermontane belt itself shows you two different stories here. King Salmon Thrust, just at the borderline separating the Intermontane from the Coast Plutonic Complex. And then down you have, you go back to volcanic, Nahalin Fault. Yeah, there are two faults there. So one minute, there's the Alokthan Sol, Alokthan Boundary. This is a sol, King Salmon Thrust and the Nahalin Fault. It shows how the Intermontane goes completely west towards the border that separates the Coast Plutonic Complex and the Intermontane. And then it flows down and all of that is Mesozoic volcanic rocks and successor sediments. But the central and eastern side of the Atlan terrain, this is on the east of the Teslin Fault Zone in BC as well as the west before you get the Mesozoic intrusion. Sylvester Alokthan, Cassia Platform is all on the Proterozoic and Paleozoic. That's autochthonous. And then you have the Rocky Mountain Trench. All of that is autochthonous per this paper. And then you have the Bowser Basin right down south. Yeah, that's starting to make sense now. In the Pelly Mountains, the eogeoclinal strata are thrust over the myogeoclinal sequence, and a similar relationship modified in many places by younger phenomenon is postulated on trend. Let's move to figure 13, mineral occurrences in southern... Oh, this is the same as figure, the first figure. This is the mineral, mineral occurrences in southern Yukon that seem to have stratigraphic control to emphasize the presence of these stratigraphic targets for mineral exploration in this region. The whole orange weathering limestone right at the bottom is still ignored. That's like the parking lot. Then you have the Quetzal River that we were looking at. And it shows the basin, Howard's Pass. It shows you Howard's Pass, Barrier Reef. That's where you had the, what was that bird? Brown limey argillite and argillaceous limestone with archaeocited reefs on the northeast side, not the southwest side, if you look at figure 1 and figure 13. It's on the northeast side, Barrier Reef right there. Lead and zinc, then you have the bedded barite, and then acid submarine tuff. Yeah, and then oh, that's it. So you have 13 figures in this, and the first and the 13th are basically the same but with other geolocations in terms of from an exploration lens. Let's look at the regional considerations mentioned in this paper. A generalized sketch map of a part of the northern Cordillera shows the boundary between the alloctonous eogeoclinal rocks and the myogeoclinal strata on which they rest, as interpreted from present work and from previous mapping of the region. We looked at figure 12. That was the sketch map. And they were looking at all the fault lines and where you see the 450-kilometer offset during the mid-Cretaceous movement of the Tintina Fault. Yeah, positing, I think, that it's related to the Big Baja BC... Big Baja. It's already a big whale. So, Baja BC. Anyways, Big Baja BC. So, we've already spoken about figure 12. Now, it says, from its position in the northern Omineka crystalline belt, the boundary is offset in a light lateral sense along the Tintina Fault. That's the dextral shear that I think Professor Zentner was talking about. This is just me guessing and trying to connect the dots here. So from its position in the northern Omineka crystalline belt, the boundary is offset in a right lateral sense along the Tintina Fault. The boundary is a gently dipping thrust fault modified in places by later faults, deformation, metamorphism, and plutonism. The contact is probably not a simple sole thrust, but an imbricate zone of faults, and the alloctonous sheet, rather than being a single coherent mass, is probably faulted and imbricated and may incorporate slices of the overridden platform. The area of low to medium grade metamorphic rocks in the northern Yukon crystalline terrain is shown as part of the alloctonous sheet, but the area may include large windows through the alloctin or important slices of the overridden myogeoclinal strata. Complication by later and possibly earlier structural events and superposed metamorphism has prohibited delineation of such features with present data. This is 1976 we're talking about. So when they say present data, they're talking about their 1975 field study. This structural interpretation of the northern Yukon crystalline terrain implies that the bulk of the rocks formerly included in the Yukon group or Birch Creek Schist are late Paleozoic. Displacement of the alloctonous sheet by about 450 kilometers provides an approximate measure of the transcurrent movement of the Tintina Fault. The next section, the last section, is just a note about guides for mineral exploration. A number of stratum-controlled mineral occurrences in southern Yukon are shown superposed on the schematic facies diagram. I keep thinking feces. Facies diagram. Couldn't they have come up with another name? Let's go back. A number of stratum-controlled mineral occurrences in southern Yukon are shown superposed on the schematic facies diagram of the myogeoclinal rocks of the Pelly Mountains. Yeah, so when I was looking at figure 1 and then trying to make sense of all the figures from 2 to 12 based on figure 1, and then finally figure 13 is actually just like they mentioned figure 1, but it's superposed from a mineral exploration lens. Moving on, the diagram emphasizes the presence in the Pelly Mountains of strata of the same facies and age as those in which various mineral occurrences are found elsewhere in southern Yukon. By inference, these stratigraphic units in the Pelly Mountains warrant careful examination. One stratigraphic unit of particular interest to mineral exploration is the strongly sheared Mississippian acid. One of the diagrams, I think, let me just look up. Figure 9 talks about the separation of the Mississippian black slate by the Porcupine Thrust. So that delineates the Cambro Ordovician phyllite and the underlying Mississippian black slate. And that's what he's referring to, I think. So he's saying one stratigraphic unit of particular interest to mineral exploration is the strongly sheared Mississippian acid, an intermediate volcanic suite that occupies the large area near the head of the Cloutier Creek. I didn't see the Cloutier Creek on the map. Where was the Cloutier Creek? Oh, Cloutier Creek. I don't know how would you pronounce this. As Professor Zentner would say, it's French. So it could be Cloutier. These rocks locally contain as much as 10 or 15% of disseminated pyrite, and they form spectacular orange and red gossans in which the rocks are deeply leached. In places, the rocks contain minor malachite on fracture surfaces, and elsewhere, lead and zinc mineralization is known. For example, the zinc-lead occurrence 6 kilometers west of the mouth of White Creek, known as the MM claim or the Arnold property, lies entirely within the sheared acid volcanic suite and not within older rocks as was previously thought. That's the acid submarine tuff and black siliceous slate. And that's the end of the paper, where they end with guides for mineral exploration. All right, so we've done the regional considerations. We've done the mineral explorations. We want to look at the mid-Cretaceous Plutonic rocks. That is interesting because it's connected to the Baja BC, at least is my guess. So let's see. Mid-Cretaceous granitic rocks occupy the cores of two broad northwest-trending arches that are flanked by mantling zones of injection migmatite up to 10 kilometers wide. The granitic rocks are medium-grained biotite quartz monzonite with distinctive large phenocrysts of subhedral pink potash feldspar. The injection migmatite is a chaotically mixed zone of relatively dark-colored mica-rich gneisses. Oh, man. Schist was easy. Now, schistose, gneissic, and schistose screens. I don't know how do they pronounce all these words. Mica-rich gneissic and schistose screens and septa invaded. What is septa invaded? Septa sounds like seven. Septa invaded by a variety of sills and dikes of lighter colored, medium to fine grained quartz monzonite. Upper Proterozoic rocks of the green argillite unit can be traced laterally into the migmatite zones. And the migmatite clearly includes the metamorphosed and partly mobilized Windermere sequence. I think the Windermere sequence had come up in Professor Zentner's Baja BC videos. Let me just review that again. I have those papers. Let me see those. The rocks contain biotite and garnet, and metamorphism was in the lower amphibolite facies. The migmatite zones with small quartz monzonite bodies represent the upper parts of a sedimentary succession metamorphosed in place at relatively low temperature and high water pressure along two roughly parallel long-lived zones of relatively high heat flow. The rocks experienced little internal deformation during metamorphism. Little internal deformation, because he spoke about the incompetent Cambro Ordovician phyllite, calcareous phyllite, which was mainly because of internal deformation, and that was separated by the competent Middle Devonian area right at the top of the hill or the mountain. In this case, I'll have to look at the kilometers to see what do I call it. They showed a range, so it's definitely a mountain range, so it's definitely part of the mountain range. And they spoke about the porcupine thrust. Oh yeah, it's right here for figure 9 on the same page that has this text about mid-Cretaceous Plutonic rocks. Broad arching of the imprecated myogeoclinal, it's imprecated, yeah, so it's, yeah, and the overlying allochthonous strata, which is the eogeoclinal strata, accompanying the slow rise of material in the zones of high heat flow. Okay, so that's a mid-Cretaceous Plutonic rock section. And then we've already gone through all the images. Let's look at the allochthonous eogeoclinal assemblage. The eogeoclinal assemblage in the southern part of the Pelly Mountains includes quartz mica schist, the metamorphic product of argillaceous chert, and siliceous slate, amphibolite, and greenstone, formerly basalt. That's why the image was, yeah, okay. And serpentinized periodite. Oh, that was the, wait, figure 10, I think. Periodite, I remember seeing that right on top. Figure 11, yeah. Serpentinized periodite forms the resistant outcrop on the top of Dunite Mountain. Dunite or Dunite, I'll have to see the, I don't know the pronunciation though. I'll go with Dunite, sounds nice. It says serpentinized periodite forms the resistant outcrops on the top of the Dunite Mountain and lies as a flat sequence on the myogeoclinal sequence. The periodite mass is interpreted as allochthonous, and its lower contract is thought to be a regional thrust fault, modified in many other places by folding, faulting, and intrusion. And so you have S1 and S2, which is right on top, the allochthonous side. It has serpentinite, and then right on top of that serpentinite is serpentinized periodite. And then below that is the line of control, as I say. So the line that delineates the autochthonous and the allochthonous assemblages. Right below that, on the northeast side, is the DM, which is the black slate with lenses of orthoquartzite and dolomite. And on the southwest, if you go with the map as indicated on figure, on the first figure and the 13th figure, I'm going by that. So I'm assuming the LE, the limestone pieces, towards the southwest. And then right below that, you have limestone lenses. And then just at the bottom, which is the autochthonous one, right, is the Precambrian rock. So that's the late Proterozoic mica schist, green argillite unit. I think this section is talking about that. So let's just go back to that section. I wanted to try something different. I didn't want to just read the paper from top to bottom. So I started with, I think, the general setting or the introduction. One of the two will come first. I don't know which one comes first when I put these together. So either the introduction or the general setting will come first. And then I think I will dive into the figures, then move to one of these blocks. I think it will start with the regional considerations and then the mineral exploratory lens and then the mid-Cretaceous Plutonic rocks, because that is definitely the Baja BC connection, because I keep thinking about that 450 kilometer offset because of the movement of the Tintana Fault. And the Yukon-Tanana terrain is what the scene is all about. So the Yukon-Tanana terrain is also part of the Baja BC narrative. The whole story basically around Baja BC includes the Yukon-Tanana terrain as well, and the Omanica crystalline belt is also right there. I was pretty much focused on the mid-Cretaceous Plutonic rocks at this particular location, which is the Pelly Mountain region. So you'll see the Porcupine Creek come up, and in scene 5, we've taken Canole Road, which is pretty far, but I wanted to bound it. So it bounds, the area gets bounded by Canole Road, and then you have the Quiet Lake Batholith, as well as the Finlayson Lake. And then you have the Porcupine Creek right there. And then the protagonist of this particular paper is the Pelly Mountains. So the range is definitely the main piece. But maybe I might go further and look into the Porcupine Thrust just to see that story. Because that's not in this paper, I believe. I'll have to look that up. Or if I don't come up with that, maybe that will be in another episode. But we're going to be, I think in scene 5... And in scene 6, we will be around the same, in the same area, the Yukon-Tanana terrain, Tintana Fault. We would look at Carmack's group, White Horse Trough, Yak Attack. I think Professor Zentner spoke about Yak Attack parallels. I'm not sure I will go that side towards Alaska. We'll probably be centered around the Yukon, maybe have a link going down, since we're talking about BC as well, then maybe towards the Alberta foreland as well. But I don't know how that will play out. But for now, that's the direction. And that's why you might find me reading chunks. I might read the whole paper, but it might be difficult to read it right from the top. I might just read it in chunks that interest me. Although I've read the whole paper and then I'm like, oh, maybe I want to start with this and then just ramble and have a tangent. So that it sounds like it's not just some research paper reading. It is molded. It's tied to my main plot about the Ouroboros in the Muggle brain and why we are now in scene 5 somewhere on Canole Road. It would tie up to that plot as well. And I think I should shut up now and just go ahead and continue reading the section on the Allochthonous Eogeoclinal assemblage. You can guess that I have no background in geology. Although I've always liked geology because my brother was studying geology, so I'm used to hearing certain terms, but not all these terms. I am literally struggling with pronunciations. I still have his textbook. There's a whole textbook on mineralogy, and I kind of hated it. And I was like, what rubbish is this? There's definitely a textbook on all the fossilized fauna. There's a full textbook on paleobotany, paleozoology. I think I have 4 textbooks. And Goa is on the oldest rocks, the Deccan Trap. So we know that story. And there is that outcrop in southern Goa, and especially my favorite place. One of the main reasons why seabirds are the mascot of the Fraser School is because of that place called Agonda in South Goa. Sukankorn will come up in a big way, but mainly from a geological lens. And the Western Ghats will come up from, again, the geological lens. So when we go to Goa in the story, whenever that is, it will be centered around, it is the oldest rock, 2.6 billion, you're talking about, 2600 million, you will come to know. Not so soon though, or maybe it might, I don't know how that script will write itself. Because right now we are in Yukon and there's a lot of content around the Yukon. We did speak about Professor Long, and so this is related to Professor Long's conversations, correspondence with Ted Irving. And that's why this whole side story comes up. Actually, it's going to be a main story because I ended up reading about Baja BC and watching a lot of videos and interviews. I think the whole series that is conducted by Professor Zentner on YouTube. So, and then I read his papers as well. So now I have all those 150 papers or 150 odd papers. 91, I think, is in the Baja folder, but there are other paleomag content that I need to look up. So that is there. So you will hear me talk about this whole area, the Yukon, BC, obviously, because it's the Baja BC story. Alberta will always come in because that's my foreland base. And it's also where my Fraser passed away. He passed away in St. Albert. I do have his ashes, but I mean, the physical dog, the real, the matter that I saw last was at Mission Ridge Hospital in St. Albert. So Alberta has my undivided heart because my Fraser is, in my head, my Fraser is resting there. Even though I have his ashes with me here, in my view, the last time I saw Fraser was in Alberta. So Alberta will always have my undivided attention. And that's why my story, wherever I end up in my story, whether I go to the Yukon, whether I go to Newfoundland, whether I go to Northern Quebec and Labrador, we look at the George River caribou. And we look at, definitely be looking at Quebec in a big way and Labrador and Newfoundland in a big way as well. And so east and west, when we talk about Canada, that will definitely be there. The whole school is based in Lapland, Finland. So that story is definitely going to come up. And obviously my home is Kuopio in eastern Finland. So I will find a way to bring that. The whole Kuopio story will probably be season 2, so will be season 3 or 4 actually, because that will take it in a different direction altogether, where we will focus on Finland. Right now the focus is not on Finland at all. Finland is just because the school is there and a couple of things around the script surround the school, and since I'm now in Canada, it's easier for me to find content related to Canada and dive deeper here. So when we look at the whole new direction, right, of Sartastic Beasts and where to find them, there will be nothing about Sar. I start my day, I'm always, in a day, I'm always reading some paper on Sar interferometry, or I'm reading something on radar, or something about its history, something that happened in 1943, something about angel echoes, birds, and stuff of that nature. So I'm always reading something there, but it's difficult to reel that in the script, because right now it doesn't fit in. It's just like I'll be trying to bring in something that will seem like an outlier in the story, and that will just be a tangent that will not even make sense. We will come back to SAR. We will come back to radar technology. That is definitely something I'm interested in. But it might not come in the script, or it might, since we are in the Yukon. Can't say anything right now. This is a fun project, by the way. I don't know how does this sound like fun, because I'm learning new geological terms. Like, which was the hardest one. So it's a little difficult to learn these words, and I was just looking at some other words before I wrap up my tangent. So three areas are important for this particular redirected podcast. One is definitely this whole Yukon, Baja, BC area. And since I am in BC, so BC, definitely Northeast BC and Alberta. And then on the eastern side, it would be Northern Quebec, Labrador and Newfoundland. That covers Canada at least. We'd be leaving out everything in between. So leaving all of that, and we might go to Thunder Bay because a good chunk of the Finnish community lives there, is what I heard. So I was like, okay, Thunder Bay is important. Besides that, I think we're just on east and west. That's it. Coast to coast, not another coast right now, just coast to coast. And then we don't move to, but the next region of interest is Finland, where the school is based. So we are primarily focused on Lapland and the glacially induced fault zones in Lapland, Sodankylä and Kittilä. Those places are basically, I think, where they mine for gold or something. But anyways, that's still a glacially induced fault zones is an area of interest. And then eastern Finland, the last region is definitely the oldest rocks. So you're talking about the Precambrian area, mainly focused on Goa, and the Western Ghats only with a Goa emphasis. So those are the three main geographic regions the story is based on. And why did I come up with all three? It actually has the connection with the Deathly Hallows as well, because we are talking about, in the episode where I spoke about the Deathly Hallows and the leader of the house, Severus Snape, being connected deeply, and the Deathly Hallows is probably connected to all three, like the Invisibility Cloak, the Elder Wand, and the Resurrection Stone. Now, we're taking all those three, and we will link them to the Thestral, and that's why I'm in the paleo habitat of the Thestral, which is why the whole prehistoric geological context comes into play, because the Thestral and the Deathly Hallows are deeply connected. They're intertwined in a way. Each part that you talk about, the Elder Wand, you talk about the Invisibility Cloak, and you talk about the Resurrection Stone, each of those parts come up in one of these locations. Like Canada, we've already hinted at the Thestral Wings being found at Partridge Creek, but it could very well be up in along Bluefish River. So it's definitely got a Yukon base there. So the Thestral Wing, which is obviously your Invisibility Cloak connection, which I will make in some episode, but that's Canada-based, and that's why Professor Newt Scamander and Professor Wanderson had relocated it from Mount Schaefer. And before that, Professor Tahathi Arvine had relocated it, and I think Ogilvie and Professor Tahathi Arvine had relocated it from northern Alberta, which is why Susi Pettonen gets the idea, or she gets a hint from Professor Scamander about looking at the Peace River embayment and looking at the geology of that area. But then how she connects that to the Yukon, and how do we come to the Yukon Tanana terrain, is described in this episode. So that area is definitely linked to the Thestral Wing / the Invisibility Cloak. That connection will definitely come in another episode. Now we have the Elder Wand and we have the Resurrection Stone. The Elder Wand is the Thestral's hair core, but that anyways has the link with the Thestral, but that would be connected to the Western Ghats. It's a biodiversity hotspot of a rare kind, so that's why I thought it's best to have the Thestral hair core, or rather the Elder Wand, being linked to the Western Ghats and the whole geology of the Precambrian area. So that's why the paleo habitat of the Thestrals is very important. It's a fictional setup, but I will create that paleo habitat. And that's why I wanted to go back to the oldest rocks and the Deccan Trap and the Western Ghats. All of that area kind of makes it well. So you will see a lot of that content when we look at the second, that is the Elder Wand. So in our story, the Invisibility Cloak is connected to the Thestral Wing and connected to Canada. When we talk about the Elder Wand, it's going to be the Western Ghats, but primarily located in Goa. So Agonda will come up in a big way, but most of Goa will be captured there. The opening of the Arabian Sea will also come up from a prehistoric geological lens, just like we had the closing of the Iapetus Ocean before the opening of the Atlantic Ocean on the eastern side. And since we are also talking about Newfoundland and the eastern side and the Appalachian, we will also go to the Scottish Highlands, which is basically, if you go back to Rodinia and you go back to the whole story prehistorically, you talk about the connections. So they will come up. I don't know when these things will come up, but for now we are going in that direction. Just take up whatever we like. Geology is definitely an area of interest. Radar and radar technology is an area of interest. My Fraser is an area of interest. And my love for the Yukon and Eastern Finland, Kuopio, Lapland also, Northern Finland. And finally, the Resurrection Stone. When we talk about the Resurrection Stone, we're talking about the heart. The concept was that you want to use a stone to bring your dead to life. And in one of my episodes where I talk about the schools, the four schools, Meri Pelle, Meri Kotka, Meri Mies, and Meri Mezzo, when we talk about Severus Snape and we talk about the Resurrection Stone and wanting to bring the dead, wanting to resurrect the people you love, and since Fraser has passed away as well. So that story will center around Eastern Finland and Lapland, obviously, Northern Finland, but basically that's the reason the school is in Finland, because that's where the Resurrection Stone is. Not at the school, but there is a story around that. So when you talk about the Deathly Hallows, the triangle forms around two northern territories, like really north. You're talking about Lapland. So Sodankylä is 68 degrees north. The whole story is around Old Crow Flats, so that's quite a high up north. And then we're going down south to 15 degrees north at the sea level, because we are looking at a coastal place, my coastal village of Goa. And it's interesting because one of the papers you talk about this whole movement, when the Himalayas hit the southernmost tip of the Eurasian Craton, basically. I will bring up that paper as well. It is a paper written by some, I think just recently I happened to read that paper while I was reading about the Paleomag. There was an upward, there's obviously compression because it hit, right? It collided. So the Indian subcontinent collided. When the Himalayas were formed, if you go by that calculation, and before the hit, we were below the equator. And right now we're at 15 degrees north above the equator. I'm talking about Goa. So I'm just looking at the geolocation of Goa and I was calculating that northward. Am I getting it right? I don't know. So you fold the mountains and there is contraction because there is a bang, a hit. The collision of the continents creates that fold. And it is the Young Fold Mountains. There's a translation. I wouldn't say translation as we talk about translation in Baja BC. There is contraction and there is a reference of about 1300 to 2100 kilometers. And that makes sense. When I was calculating, Goa was like, yeah, it's, and if you go with by what Professor Zentner said, that 1 degree latitude, it's about 110 kilometers. When you're looking at Goa at 15 degrees north right now, if you go by that movement, by the contraction, it was below the equator at that time. So that's why I was like, oh, when you calculate that distance, I'm counting Goa to, let's say, the northern tip is around 2,700 kilometers. So when you're talking about contraction, and if that didn't contract, if you were... I'm now thinking about phase unwrapping. So if you're unwrapping the phase, the folds that happened, the Young Fold Mountain, if you unfold it, again, a David Bohm reference of enfolding and unfolding. But if you unfold the mountain, the folding that happened, or as you talk in radar terms, if you unwrap the phase and if you stretch it down, then Goa falls below the equator, within south of the equator. And that's why this was important, because I think when I talk about Goa, although I don't need to speak about the Himalayas, but I think that paper will come up, the one that I've read, but only in reference to the paleomagnetic data and only in reference to the geolocation of Goa, prehistorically as well as now. Although you can't really say it's prehistorically, because India was moving at, I think, to 25 centimeters per year, 250 millimeters per year, the movement of the Indian subcontinent. So that was a speed. I think there's a good speed here as well when you talk about the Baja BC. I haven't seen all the 28 episodes, so I still have to see a couple of episodes to see what was the speed. But I think we're talking about 250 millimeters per year for the Indian subcontinent, for the speed to hit the southernmost tip of Eurasia at that point in time. And that was my long tangent. And I want to kind of, I don't know if I'll put that in, but I will look at how it sounds right now. And that was a very long tangent. I don't know if I'll have all of this. I will see how that sounds. Extemporaneously speak something and see, maybe I will chop it up, but maybe not. At the moment, we will definitely, I need to read this paper because we are in 1976. And the reason I picked up Jan 1976 is because this report by the Geological Survey of Canada has this paper and it's exactly where I wanted to be. I was looking at a location along the Yukon-Tanana terrain, something around that line of inquiry, because I was reading about Baja BC. So I wanted to do something along the same lines. And I knew 1976 is when we're going back in time, because there was a conversation, a set of dialogues between David Bohm and the chief healer, who you know by now was Jiddu Krishnamurti. So this conversation happened in 19... There were, I think, 15 dialogues between the two. And in one of the dialogues, he actually makes a good statement. And that's the clue he's talking about, because he actually figured it out. Truth acts in reality through death. And this comes up, I think it's the 1976 or the 1975 dialogue, one of the dialogues, but We wanted to be in 1975, 1976. And we wanted to be in this area because of the whole Baha BC story. And then this paper is what I wanted to read because it's exactly, I wasn't even expecting this paper. Like I wasn't, the paper is not something I was concerned about. I wasn't expecting this location to show up in the 1976 Geological Survey of Canada report. Like that was interesting. I was like, oh wow, that's excellent. I was looking at 1976 along the Yukon and seeing what reports are there. And then I found this paper and I was like, oh, this is exactly where we want to be, Canole Road. Not exactly along Canole Road, but somewhere there. And the Porcupine Creek and the Pelly Mountains, all of that makes perfect sense. And then I'm like, okay, fine. Anyways, I'm reading that whole area. And I was just casually reading this paper, but then the whole 450 kilometer offset came up. And I was like, oh, this is a connection to the Baha BC story. So maybe I need to dig in deeper. And that's when I happened to read it again. And that's when I decided, okay, let's include this paper. There are the other two papers as well, but this paper is important. There are the other two or three papers I want to talk about. Maybe, I'm not sure if I'll put them in, but I wanted to have this. And so, with that extremely long tangent, I think we need to get back and just cover up the last few. We've already covered up the mineral exploration lens. We've covered up the considerations for the region. We've kind of covered up the general setting, the introduction, the mid-Cretaceous plutonic rock section. Now we are at the allochthonous eogeoclinal assemblage. So the eogeoclinal assemblage in the southern part of the Pelly Mountains includes quartz, mica, schist, the metamorphic product of argillaceous chert and siliceous slate, amphibolite and greenstone, formerly basalt, and serpentinized peridotite. This was where the tangent started, was when we were talking about figure 11. So this was in reference to, and that's when the tangent started. So just to jog your memory again, like, hey, that was a long tangent and completely lost track. But this is what we were talking about. Moving on. The metamorphism in the lower green schist facies was accompanied by extensive shearing and the development of foliation. The age and internal stratigraphy of this assemblage is unknown. Parts resemble the Anvil Range group, while other sections are like the low-grade metamorphic rocks found in the contiguous Englishman's Complex and the Sylvester group. On the basis of these broad similarities and the few fossil collections made in equivalent strata, the eogeoclinal rocks of the southern Pelly Mountains may be largely or in part late Paleozoic. The eogeoclinal rocks lie on the myogeoclinal sequence, and a single sharp, gently dipping contact, not modified by later events, separates the two assemblages. And that's what you see in figure 11. You see the line of control, or the line that delineates the allochthonous assemblage, and that's the eogeoclinal assemblage, and the myogeoclinal assemblage, which is right down the green schist. Have I got that correct? Right down with limestone outcrops right below in the autochthonous assemblage. In most places, the youngest beds of the underlying sequence are the Mississippian black slate and orange weathered chert. That shows up right in figure 11 and 13, and you know that that's what they're talking about. Next is, south of McNeil Lake, the middle Triassic beds are exposed beneath the eogeoclinal rocks. In most places, the eogeoclinal strata are distinctly more metamorphosed than the myogeoclinal sequence on which they lie. These relations indicate that the eogeoclinal rocks are allochthonous and are thrust over the myogeoclinal strata. Emplacement of the allochthon post-dates the middle Triassic, but predates the latest Triassic and therefore occur during late Triassic, perhaps Carnian. Did they mean Carmian? I don't know. There's a question mark there. Carmian. So we're done with the mid-Cretaceous plutonic rock section. We're done with the allochthonous eogeoclinal assemblage. The next section is the structure of the myogeoclinal sequence. The myogeoclinal succession is imprecated by northeasterly directed thrust faults, as you see in figure 8. Let's quickly go to figure 8, where they talk about those limestone units. They're just about 150 meter thick repetitions. They're just lines around that northeast dipping, and that's northwest of the Big Salmon Lake. The myogeoclinal succession is impregnated by northeasterly directed thrust faults, which involve strata as young as middle Triassic. One of these thrusts is folded over an open syncline-anticline pair across 15 kilometers. the internal response of the different rocks to the imprecation by thrusting varies with the lithology and the degree to which the rocks are metamorphosed. Argillaceous strata below the Middle Devonian are folded and bedding is transposed to various degrees, as seen in figure 21.10, whereas the competent Silurian siltstone and the Middle Devonian carbonate are faulted, but show little internal deformation. Consequently, an important zone of detachment, as shown in figure 8, separates the relatively incompetent Ordovician and older strata from the overlying Silurian siltstone. Southwestward, where the myogeoclinal sequence is weakly metamorphosed, the detachment zone has migrated up section and is found between the thick bedded Middle Devonian carbonate and the siltstone beneath it. And now we're done with this section. We're done with the structure of the myogeoclinal sequence. Let's see if there's something else we want to read. Oh, we're right at the last section now. We've done the introduction. We've done the general setting. Now we're at the last section. That is the stratigraphy and facies relations of the myogeoclinal rocks. The first figure is a schematic diagram of the facies relations of the main stratigraphic units across the Pelly Mountains. It portrays two important breaks in sedimentation. One about Middle Cambrian time, and the second during late Silurian and early Devonian time. The diagram also demonstrates that the sequence on the northeast near the Tintana Trench is nearly complete, but that much of the early Paleozoic sequence on the southwest is missing, presumably through erosion. The Windermere to Lower Cambrian sequence is relatively uniform in facies across the Pelly Mountains. Generally, it resembles a succession of the same age to the south in the Omeneca crystalline belt. The continuity of facies of this assemblage across the Pelly Mountains and along much of the Omeneca crystalline belt implies long-lived stable depositional conditions. The Upper Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian succession can be divided into four lithologically distinct units. Near Tintana Trench, Upper Cambrian calcareous slate and phyllite and argillaceous limestone overlie the Lower Cambrian rocks unconformably. The calcareous slate, about 1,000 meter thick, is overlain conformably by about 1,000 meters of recessive weathering black graptolitic slate, ranging from early to late Ordovician. Locally, the black slate contains thin beds of medium-grained orthoquartzite, thin flows of intermediate volcanic rocks, thin discontinuous beds of dolomitized mudstone, and lenses of crinoidal waxstone. Is that the gray waxstone? Southwestward, these two lithological units lose their identity, and as a result of a change in facies, merge to be replaced by a third unit, which is 1,500 to 2,000 meters of non-calcareous medium-gray phyllite with abundant intermediate to basic volcanic flows and sills in its upper part. The fourth unit, Lower and Middle Silurian, laminated to thin-bedded dolomitic siltstone, overlies the black graptolithic slate or the equivalent non-calcareous phyllite and is intertongued with these rocks at the contact. The upper part contains lenses of dolomitized crinoidal packstone and waxstone. Rusty weathering purple and green tuff of intermediate composition are locally important with the dolomite. The entire siltstone unit represents a gradual shoaling from the relatively deep water, restricted environment under which the black graptolite unit was laid down. The volcanic rocks are submarine flows. The Upper Cambrian calcareous phyllite and Ordovician black graptolitic slate are equivalent to and of the same facies as the Kachika group. Their facies equivalent, the non-calcareous phyllite with abundant volcanics, is identical to the phyllite unit in the Anvil district. A disconformity and elsewhere an angular unconformity separates the Middle and Lower Devonian dolomite and orthoquartzite from the underlying strata. That's on figure 3. On the northeast, the Middle Devonian sequence includes, from the base up, about 600 meters of thick-bedded light gray dolomite, 700 of thin-bedded brownish-weathered silty dolomite, 300 meters of dolomitic mudstone, 800 meters of thin-bedded brownish-weathered silty dolomite, and 300 meters of light gray medium-grained orthoquartzite. This sequence was deposited in an intertidal environment, but parts represent supratidal deposition. To the southwest, the upper part of the dolomite sequence is replaced by 800 meters of medium-bedded, medium to light gray, mature orthoquartzite and sandy dolomite, evidently deposited in a beach environment. Mississippian black siliceous slate with minor grayback, roughly 500 meter thick, overlies the dolomite and sandstone sequence in many places without a significant break. The black slate is a transgressive sequence that represents a return to deeper water, quiet sedimentation, following subsidence of the stable shelf on which the underlying carbonate rocks formed. Lenses of thinly laminated barite, locally as thick as 50 meters, occur in the upper part of the black slate unit. Conodonts and brachiopods, tentatively identified as mid-Mississippian, were collected from the upper part of the black slate. The slate is overlain by 100 meters of orange-weathered, thin-bedded, pale-green tefaceous chert, which is in turn covered by laminated, strongly bioturbated shale and siltstone. The slate is overlain by 100 meters of orange-weathered, thin-bedded, pale-green tefaceous chert, which is in turn covered by laminated, strongly bioturbated shale and siltstone, several hundred meters thick. Silty and sandy, medium-gray, thin-bedded limestone, as much as 500 meters thick, overlies the siltstone and contains middle or upper Triassic conodonts. We're done with the paper with so many mistakes and so many mispronunciations. This is a good read because actually reading this paper was interesting because it now helps me see the Baja BC connection a little more clearly. I still have to read all the papers. Currently, I'm done only with 24 now by now, but there are 91 in that Baja folder. And then I have other papers there. So I think it's a total of 150 at this point. That's why I said it will take a while to get through this story. And since we are diving in, it's fun to read. If it gets boring, like if it feels like a job, then I will stop reading it. But it's I don't think I ever get bored reading papers. And geology has always been interesting. So this is fun. And so grateful, actually, to Professor Zentner for his Baja BC series. Because, I mean, I was watching a lot of his videos before, but the Baja BC series just helped me dive in. And I think if he hadn't interviewed, I think, Professors Merlbeck, definitely. I watched both the videos of interviews with Merlbeck. That was definitely, like, wow. But I think it was Randy Yenkins. Yeah, I think it was Randy Yenkins' interview. And then Stephen Johnson's Yellowstone in Yukon, the Big Flush claim, that kind of piqued my interest. And then I was like, okay, fine, I need to dive into this Baja BC series. I will also talk about something people consider as pseudoscience. For me, like I said, I don't care. It's a fun project. I'm retired. I'm no longer a tech person, even if it's pseudoscience. I think there's a lot of merit in what he says. I will talk about content by Rupert Sheldrake, because it was Rupert Sheldrake who introduced me to William Long's material. So that's why I think I will read about the conversation that Rupert Sheldrake and David Bohm had about radio wave as a morphogenetic field. I think I should leave you with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sartastic Beast and Where to Find Them. The intro and outro music is by Yaakov Goldman, courtesy of Free Music Archive.